Thank you so much for being here this evening. Before we move into the question and answer portion of the evening, I would like to call your attention to a couple of business items. The first is the baskets that will be coming around the room. As Scott mentioned earlier in the evening, tonight we have chosen to support Rabbis for Human Rights and Christian Peacemaker Teams. We ask that you be as generous as possible in your donations so that we can continue to support the courageous work of these two organizations. Additionally, if you have any questions for Dr. Finkelstein, please put them on the 3x5 cards that were distributed earlier in the evening and pass them to the center aisles where they will be collected. The question and answer portion of the evening will be handled by a panel. Our panelists have been instructed that all questions are fair game, so you are free to be as provocative as you like with Dr. Finkelstein. Our two panelists are George Cadman, a programmer at Free Radio Santa Cruz and host of the show Peace Talks on Free Radio Santa Cruz. George is also a local activist who has traveled extensively in Palestine with the International Solidarity Movement. Our other panelist you met earlier this evening, Dalit Baum, professor of women's studies at California State University, Monterey Bay. Please be aware that we have very little time. We need to have the building cleared by 10 p.m. So when the session is concluded, please move quickly but peacefully outside and continue your conversations on the street. Thanks.
We'll start with, will you please talk about Arafat? I always heard how crazy and bad he was. However, Palestinian friend of mine said that it was not true. I mean, they want you to respond to this.
I think there are two separate issues on the question of Arafat. Namely, number one, as a leader of the Palestinian people, and that's a responsibility for Palestinians to judge and not myself. And the second issue is, namely, whether he was an obstacle to resolving the Israel-Palestine conflict. And the second issue, it seems to me, we can look at a documentary record and come to a fairly clear conclusion. The PLO, under the leadership of Yasser Arafat from the mid-1970s, supported a two-state settlement and supported the international consensus for resolving the conflict. That's not controversial at all because they were voting for it and supporting it in many different fora at the United Nations and elsewhere. So on the question of whether Arafat was, as we're constantly told, the main obstacle to resolving the conflict, that Arafat blocked a resolution in the year 2000 during the Camp David and later Taba negotiations, I think the diplomatic record, is very clear there, and the answer is a resounding no.
And another question here is, what is the real hidden agenda that dominates U.S. policy regarding Israel? Why is suppression of information regarding
I think there's no possibility of resolving that question here, and I don't think there's been any definite resolution of the question in the scholarly literature. There are basically two camps. Everybody in this room is familiar with those two camps. One camp says that Israel serves U.S. strategic interests in the Middle East and is basically a garrison state or a watchdog of U.S. interests in the Middle East. And the other claim is there's a powerful Jewish, sometimes it's called Jewish, sometimes Zionist, sometimes Israeli lobby, which is shaping and determining U.S. policy when it comes to the Middle East. I think that's one of those questions where I think people can legitimately disagree. I think that it's a question for which I've not seen any definite responses, which are absolutely convincing. I think you can find examples where the Israel lobby or Jewish lobby or Zionist lobby proved to be very powerful, and then there are instances where the U.S. government decide this is not in our interest and put Israel in its place. You can find examples on both sides, and I don't think there is a clear-cut answer to that question. And some people may argue, and I think there's some truth to it, the question has become moot nowadays because Israel and the United States have become so interlocked that to speak of Israel on the one side and the United States on the other it's kind of an artificial separation. It's like asking the question, does President Bush serve Texan interests or American interests? Nobody raises that sort of question. Some people think it's Texas, okay? Well, most rational people don't think it's a significant question, and it may no longer be a significant question in the case of Israel and the United States.
Next question is, you spoke of the wall that Israel is constructing in the West Bank. The majority of Israelis support this wall. Doesn't the Israeli government have the right and the obligation to protect its citizens from terrorist attacks by Palestinians? Proponents of this wall argue that it will greatly reduce terrorism, that there would be no need for the wall if Palestinian leaders would rein in Palestinian extremists.
Well, let's be clear about basic matters. Israel has every right to build a wall, as any sovereign state has a right to build a wall. It has a right to build a wall on its property, but it doesn't have the right to build a wall on another people's property. That's the only issue. That was the only issue that came up in the World Court decision. It's not a complicated question for Americans. My parents, we lived in Brooklyn, New York. We owned a house. My parents were difficult people. They didn't get along with anyone. Actually, they didn't even get along with each other. So, on the one side were the Golds, and the other side were the Kasslers. And they did not get along with the Golds, and they did not get along with the Kasslers. So they built a fence. And it was within their right to build a fence. But as everybody knows, when you build a fence at any rate in New York, you first have to hire a surveyor. That's a fact. I'm not joking. You have to hire a surveyor. And you have to make sure that that fence is right down the line on your property. Because if that fence is literally 1/4 inch on the Gold side or on the Kassler side, they have the right to tear it down under law. That's it. Now, let's take Israel's wall. What happens if my parents decide to build a fence that's not only on the Kassler side, but goes right around their swimming pool? Well, some people will begin to wonder, are Mary and Harry Finkelstein trying to protect their property, or are they trying to steal the Kassler's swimming pool? Now, it happens... It happens that the Israeli fence takes in the most productive water and land resources on the West Bank. So you begin to wonder whether it's about terrorism or is it about theft. Now, what happens if my parents' fence went not only right around the pool, but went straight through the living room? Well, then you begin to wonder whether my parents are trying to get rid of the Kasslers. Now, it happens that Israel's fence is cutting the West Bank in half and making any possibility of a Palestinian state null and void. That's what all the human rights organizations are saying. If you divide the West Bank in half and you annex Jerusalem, which accounts for 1/2 to 2/3 of the whole Palestinian GNP, there's no Palestinian state. It's over. So that's the issue. There's no question about Israel's right to build a wall on its border. And that's the only question.
The next question touches upon a very interesting ongoing debate in the I want to state. It seems that Baltistan is the only political entity in Israel who grants the Palestinians. Why don't the Palestinians give up the two-state idea and instead demand full political rights as Israeli citizens?
Well, you know, that question constantly comes up, and I don't want to give a glib answer to it because I happen to think that's another area where people, honest people, can disagree. I'll just give you my opinion on the topic. The prospects of a one-state solution are very far off in the future, and people have to be honest about that. It's not a snap solution. And you have to ask yourself the question, and it's a serious moral question. It's about moral responsibility. When you start advocating a one-state settlement, you're confining the Palestinians who are now living under a miserable occupation. You're consigning them to perhaps another century of misery, because that's what we're talking about if you're arguing for a one-state settlement. Now, some people may argue, well, there's no other alternative because the two-state settlement is dead. I'd say there's an argument there. I'm not going to dispute it. But I think a morally responsible position is if there's even a 5% possibility of the two-state settlement and ending the Israeli occupation within our lifetime, then that's the position we should be fighting for. As a general rule, I don't think it's a complicated question. You know, people say one state, two states. Well, I'm of the old school of thought. I think the world would be a very nice place with no states. So it's not just, you know, Palestine and Israel. It's the whole world. But I don't have to bear any consequences for making that statement, because I'm very secure in my United States, or at least up to now. With my American citizenship and my American passport, I'm not living under occupation. But when you start advocating that for Palestinians, you have to be very careful about what you're doing, because you're in effect saying from now through a very long period into the future, they're going to have to live with that occupation. And you have to be very morally responsible before you condemn people to that fate.
Next question. Professor Finkelstein, you have been criticized for saying you support Hezbollah. Could you explain your thoughts on this claim and if there's any basis for it?
No, there's excellent basis for it. At Columbia, they say they held up signs, Columbia University, they held up signs saying, I love Hezbollah. I thought that was overstating it. I like it a lot. I don't think the Hezbollah question is particularly complicated. We have, with all due respect, we have oldsters in the room. And I think a lot of the oldsters, in particular of their Jewish descent, they were 100% behind the Red Army's victory over the fascist occupation. And they were thrilled when that Red Army smashed the Nazi war machine. And I'm sure a lot of the oldsters in this room were thrilled at the communist and socialist resistances in many of the countries of Western Europe to the Nazi occupation. Now, Stalin's record on human rights was not exactly what you would call stellar. And neither was the record of the communist parties. But we all recognize the right of any people to resist a foreign occupation of their land. And the Hezbollah resisted the brutal Israeli occupation of Lebanon and dealt them a swift blow and defeat. I, for one, am very glad about that. I think foreign occupiers should be thrown out of countries. And I personally would be the very worst hypocrite in the world were I to condemn the Hezbollah for its defeat of the Israeli occupation, whereas to this day, I still celebrate the defeat of the Stalin's Red Army and the communist resistances to the Nazi occupation of Europe. I refuse to be a hypocrite. They had the right to expel the foreign occupiers, so does Hezbollah. It was a splendid victory.
One question here is titled the economic question, which I would ask is, where is the money? But I will read it. Considering the cost of war, loss of revenue from tourism, etc., the settlements must be the most expensive real estate in the world. Did anybody ever do the calculation?
I didn't hear the question, though. Excuse me.
Did anybody ever do the calculation? But I would ask, where is the money?
You mean, where does it come from?
No, why is it profitable in the
movement? Oh, why are they investing in the settlements? Well, that's a good question. What is the rationale behind the settlements? And actually, the book that I mentioned earlier in my talk, The Accidental Empire, is supposedly an analysis of that question, how Israel came to build the settlements in the occupied territories. I don't agree with his argument at all. his basic argument is that the basically he's arguing that the religious crazies took over organizations like Gush Emunim and so forth, and the government was unable to rein them in. I don't think that's really what happened. Israel, from early on, it had a conception of what the Israeli state should look like. Come 1947, there's a partition of Palestine. They never really accepted those partition borders because they felt that they should have more of Palestine. They should have really the whole of Palestine, which included for them, depending on who you're talking about, Jordan, parts of Lebanon, the Sinai, and so forth. 1948, during the war, they expand beyond the partition borders, and they now have 77-78% of Palestine. 1956, they invade Egypt along with the French and the British. They conquer Gaza. They conquer Sinai. Unfortunately for them, the Americans at that point said to get out. And they always had a fairly large conception of their view of what their state should be. Their main problem come 1967 is a very basic problem. They want the land, but all those Arabs, and they still want a Jewish state. So how do you preserve a Jewish state with all those Arabs? 1948, they solved that problem by expelling the Arabs. But in 1967, for various reasons, not least of which the war was so short, they only managed to expel about 250,000-300,000 Arabs. After the war, they have all these ideas. Levi Eshkol, who's the prime minister, he says, let's take those Gazan refugees and settle them in Iraq. And they were trying to settle them in Iraq, and they got rid of around 100,000 that way. But in the end, it didn't pan out. So they want the land, but there's a problem of the people. And the way they tried to resolve that problem is basically the South Africa style, namely create Bantustans, stuff the Arabs in as dense an area as possible, and then keep the rest for yourself. And there was an interesting quote I came across, a remark I came across yesterday. Mr. Sharon is still convinced that can work, because he said the problem in South Africa was there were many more blacks than whites, and the ratio was such that the Bantustans couldn't work. But he remains confident that because of the population, the ratio is pretty even in Israel-Palestine. The Bantustan policy can work. They'll have all of these little enclaves where they'll stick the Arabs, sort of like our Native American reservations, and they'll have it encircled by white settlements, and they think it can work. It's an interesting question because it's one where I think ideology is more significant than rational interests. They remain, at some level, Zionists, and they have a conception of what their state should look like, and they're sticking hard and fast to that ideology and then trying to accommodate the reality of all those Arabs and what to do with them.
So we were given 15 more minutes.
Good.
So we do have time for a couple more questions here.
Good.
I'm going to ask one of my own. Outside earlier, there was some leaflets being handed out. Maybe some people received them. I read one of the quotes on here that was attributed to Finkelstein. It says, Finkelstein accuses Jewish leaders of being, quote, Jew liars who huckster their dead, unquote, and in page 127 in his book, The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering. When I actually went to that page, it says, anti-Semites gleefully mock the, quote, Jew liars who even, quote, huckster their dead. In fact, what Martin was doing was quoting anti-Semites, and they attributed this quote to him. So I went outside to talk to them. They didn't talk to them.
Well, I want to be clear. I want to be clear about that. But I want to be, you know, I want to be faithful to the record. I don't shy away from a laugh, and I don't shy away from undiplomatic language. But I'm deadly serious about what I write, and I'm very careful about what I say. They are acting like hucksters, and they are huckstering the dead. And that's what's so godly awful about the whole thing, that they have turned, these people have turned the Nazi Holocaust into a racket. It's not me that originated this brilliant idea. You take the most authoritative scholar on the Nazi Holocaust in the world, Raoul Hilberg. For any of you who have studied the subject, you'll know Raoul Hilberg's The Destruction of the European Jews, his three-volume study, is the standard one on the topic. And nobody disputes he is the dean of Nazi Holocaust historians. It was Raoul Hilberg, not Norman Finkelstein, who in 1999 said that Jews are, I'm quoting him literally, Jews are, for the first time in their history, they're making use of the blackmail weapon. They are blackmailing, this is my part now, they are blackmailing the Swiss banks, the German industrialists, to extract what they call Holocaust compensation for needy Holocaust victims. That was all sheer fakery. It was a fraud. It was a disgusting fraud for several reasons. Number one, it was exploiting the most colossal chapter in Jewish suffering and turning it into a blackmail racket. Number two, the claims that were being made against the Swiss banks and the German industrialists were simply not true. Number three, when they got the money, which they extracted in the name of quote-unquote needy Holocaust victims, the needy Holocaust victims never saw any of the money. The money went into the pockets of these Jewish organizations and of these settlement class action lawyers. It was, exactly as I say in the book, it was a double shakedown. Now, there are a couple of things that are just worth noticing. Number one, not only were they turning the Nazi Holocaust into a shakedown racket, not only were they huckstering the Nazi Holocaust, acting exactly like stereotypes straight out of Der Stürmer, but what's worse was, and it's one of those weird ironies when you study the record, they were turning into the world's leading Holocaust deniers. Well, how can that be? It's not so complicated. In order to extract the monies from the Swiss and the Germans, they had to claim there were all of these needy Holocaust victims out there. Well, they started to escalate the numbers of survivors. And each year, if you read the publications, and I document it, each year the number of survivors started to increase. So, you now had claims, for example, they claim that in the year 2025, the year 2025, they said tens of thousands of Nazi Holocaust survivors will still be alive. In the year 2025, 90 years after the end of World War II, tens of thousands of Holocaust survivors are going to be alive. Well, if you start increasing the numbers of survivors and you have an absolute number population, you end up decreasing the number of victims. As my late mother used to say, and they get so enraged when I quote her, I don't like to bring in personal biography. It's relevant now. I will. My late mother and my late father were survivors of the Nazi Holocaust, both of them survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto. After the ghetto, my mother was in Majdanek concentration camp and two slave labor camps. My father was in Auschwitz concentration camp and the Auschwitz death march. And my mother used to go around saying, if everyone who claims to be a Holocaust survivor actually is one, who did Hitler kill? Everyone's a survivor. And that's what they were doing. They were turning, so some of you know this fellow David Irving, the so-called Holocaust denier. And David Irving would go around saying, one of his famous quips was, an Auschwitz survivor is born every day. Well, you know what the problem was? The problem was, according to the Holocaust industry, it was true. An Auschwitz survivor was being born every day, because they were increasing the numbers to justify extracting more compensation monies from the Europeans. There was no basis for these numbers. You take the fellow who just passed away a few weeks ago, Simon Wiesenthal. Some of you know him as the famed Nazi hunter. I didn't particularly go for the fellow, but he was in the camps. You asked him last year how many survivors are still around. His figure, he said 10 or 15,000 at most. But you read these people, tens of thousands will be alive in 2025 or 2035. You know what's funny? I buried my parents in 1995. According to actuarial charts, I won't be alive in 2035. I won't. But they're saying tens of thousands will still be alive.
I wanted to get to the point of my question. Why you felt it was important to write this book, The Holocaust?
Well, I felt there were three reasons to write The Holocaust Industry. Number one, I was involved in the Israel-Palestine conflict, and it was quite clear that the Nazi Holocaust was being used as a bludgeon to silence criticism of Israel. That was the political motive. And then there was a personal motive. I honestly believed, and here I have to, again, go into the area of personal biography. I was very close to my late parents, and I was as sensitive as anyone could be to their suffering, and I thought they deserved better. I didn't think that the Nazi Holocaust should be reduced to the moral stature of a Monte Carlo casino, and that's what was being done. And also, finally, because I think as a historical phenomenon, it's significant. I'm not saying it's the most significant, and I'm not saying it's unique, but I think there's an enormous amount that you can learn from it. And when I read the memoirs, in particular the ones from right after World War II, the wonderful one, which it's very hard to get now, by Ella Lingens-Reiner, called Prisoners of Fear. Some of you know Alex Coburn, and he was recently writing on the topic. And I asked him, please read Ella Lingens-Reiner's Prisoners of Fear. And he wrote me the other day, and he said, you know, I picked it up, I couldn't put it down. There's a lot of stuff, you know, lots been written, which really moves, which has depth, which has profundity, and you can learn a lot from it. The problem is you can't learn anything from the topic now, because the Nazi Holocaust has been hijacked by a gang of hucksters. And that's a real problem, and I thought they needed to be exposed. And that was the purpose of the book. And I have no apologies for it. In fact, one of the weird things is things I couldn't possibly have imagined. You know, it was like just skimming the surface when I wrote the book. Who would have imagined that Dr. Israel Singer, the head of the World Jewish Congress, who was attacking the Swiss bankers because of those secret Jewish bank accounts, who would have imagined that this past year, Dr. Israel Singer, it turns out, he took out a secret Swiss bank account where he was throwing in World Jewish Congress money. Now, that's funny. Or who would have imagined the lead counsel for the Holocaust victims, this fellow named Bert Newborn at New York University, went around saying, I'm doing it pro bono. I'm doing it pro bono. And I used to call him the pro bono Holocaust huckster. Who would have imagined that Bert Newborn, who was doing it pro bono, he said, I'm doing it for my daughter. She was a rabbinical student. She died prematurely from a heart attack, and I'm doing it for her. Who would have imagined Bert Newborn, the pro bono Holocaust huckster, took $5 million from the German settlement? And then this past month, he put in a bill for $4.1 million in the Swiss settlement. That's the pro bono Holocaust huckster. I'm doing it for free, he said. It's all a bad joke. And if I can say finally in my own defense, let them say what they want. But the world's leading authority in the Nazi Holocaust, bar none, is Raoul Hilberg. And Hilberg wrote, I'll ask you, just read the back of the book. Just read this part, if you can. Because I don't have my reading glasses, I'm sorry.
Raoul Hilberg comments on the first edition of The Holocaust Industry.
Yeah.
When I read Finkelstein's book, The Holocaust Industry, at the time of its appearance, I was in the middle of my own investigations of these matters, and I came to the conclusion that he was on the right track. I refer now to the part of the book that deals with the claims against the Swiss banks and the other claims pertaining to forced labor. I would now say, in retrospect, that he was actually conservative, moderate, and that his conclusions are trustworthy. He is a well-trained political scientist, has the ability to do the research, did it carefully, and has come up with the right results. I am by no means the only one who, in the coming months or years, will totally agree with Finkelstein's breakthrough.
Not bad. Just as a matter of the factual record, Hilberg is a conservative Republican. I'm at the other end of the spectrum, certainly. But we both have one quality in common. We respect facts. We respect truth. And it was a meeting ground for us. He told me, I met him subsequently, he said he was getting calls literally every week from Elie Wiesel and from the Holocaust Museum in Washington, begging him to remove his endorsement from my book. And he said he wouldn't, because what I wrote was true. And I think that's an insightful episode. It tells you that however much people differ on ideologies, if you agree, if you're respectful of facts and truth, there's a lot more common ground than you would imagine. A month ago, I debated Israel's former foreign minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami, on Amy Goodman's program, Democracy Now! You'd be very surprised. There was no rancor, hardly any disagreement, except at the very end. Why? In my opinion, because Shlomo Ben-Ami is, firstly, professionally, he's a historian. His field of expertise is the Spanish Civil War. And he's, secondly, a diplomat. He respected facts. He respected truth. For those of you who've watched the tape, how many of you have watched it just out of curiosity? Notice, not one time did he say, you're lying. That's not true. He never said it. He never even brought up issues like anti-Semite, Holocaust denier. He's serious. He was serious about facts. And that's the validation of the main thesis of my remarks this evening. Among serious people, among honest people, among people who've studied the record, whether you're a conservative Republican or you're on the far left like myself, there's very little controversy. There really is very little disagreement. It's only when you drag in all of this nonsense about Holocaust deniers and the other one, it's kind of funny. Allow me 1/2 second. It's kind of funny. I'm charged with two things, the same two things all the time. I'm either accused of exploiting the fact that my parents passed through the Nazi Holocaust, or I'm accused of being a Holocaust denier. Now, how can you be both? People say, oh, Finkelstein always brings up the fact that his family was exterminated by the Nazis. Yes, I do. But they say, Finkelstein, he's a Holocaust denier. How can it be both? Because none of these labels mean anything anymore. They've been turned into the verbal equivalent of spittle. There's only a matter of time before Holocaust denier enters the dictionary of American slang as an equivalent of the F word. So probably in around 10 words, people will be saying Holocaust you or mother Holocauster. It doesn't mean anything.
I think I'm just going to suggest...